Live from Midtown Tucson, this is Power Talk 1210 Studios presenting Solomon on Blast with Doug Martin and Pastor Fred.
Then wisdom appeared and she told me not to partake of that bread.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to Solomon on Blast here on Power Talk 1210, KEV Tucson, Sahuarita. I am back this week. I was out last week, if you didn't know. So
welcome back, Doug.
Thanks, Oscar.
I'm good to see you.
out of sorts here. A whole week off.
When you left, Fred said you were suspended.
Oh, really? That's okay. I probably deserved it. But I am back. So, good morning, everybody. And like I said, welcome to Solomon on Blast. This is the day the Lord has made, and we will rejoice and be glad in it. At least that's what Solomon's father, King David, says to do in Psalms. And nothing wrong with that. And nothing wrong with referencing some of King Solomon's stuff, because I'm sure Solomon got some of his wisdom from his father. But that's what we plan on doing today. We're going to do some rejoicing and singing today, but don't worry, I'm not going to torture anybody, not here on the program. Maybe Fred and Oscar will, but I don't plan on it. Anyways, I have to remind everybody today at 2 p.m., you'll want to be at the Tucson Mall Center Court for the Hear Our Voices Power Talk 1210 Flash Mob, where we will be singing the national anthem. It's a patriotic event to let all the politicians know that this is not about left or right. It's not about black or white, but it's about the red, white, and blue. We want you to show up and show your patriotism. So even if you just want to come out and watch, we want you there. The station manager, Jim Parisi, is at this moment, I'm sure, calmly and coolly getting things ready. I don't think he's nervous at all. Right? Stop laughing, Oscar. I know Jim's going crazy over there, but the hour approaches. So if you do show up, just make sure you get a American flag from whoever's passing them out. Be ready at 2 p.m. to start singing. We think there'll be enough people there that, you know, if you're a really bad singer and you don't want to be too embarrassed, you can hide in the crowd and sing with the crowd. So there'll be enough people there. The event falls in line with what we're trying to do every week on this show, you know, and that is to get people to think wisely, to participate in the things that are important. Don't forget, the election is Tuesday. Everybody's telling you that. But it's our responsibility and privilege, even, as citizens of the country to participate in the elections. Like I said, it's not about left-wing Democrats or right-wing Republicans, but it's really about what is right versus what is wrong. And Solomon's pretty clear that knowledge and understanding of what is right and wrong and making the decision to follow what is right and wrong, and to follow what is right, specifically, is what really leads to wisdom. Unfortunately, a great deal of confusion we see in our culture today is politically driven, and it comes from both of the parties, both sides of the fence. Has that always been the case? I kind of wonder sometimes whether that's always been the case. What do you think? And as usual, as always, you can give us a call, 520-750-7456. We'd like to hear your thoughts also, where you're going, what you think with regards to the election coming up. I think when you speak in general terms, most people would agree that the current set of politicians are a problem. Just look at the approval rating for Congress right now. There's a recent Rasmussen report says this past week the survey finds that just 8% of likely U.S. voters think Congress is doing a good or excellent job. That's just 8%. 62% rate their performance as poor. And that's in the general. But when it comes down to the specific, people just don't seem to really quite line up with what they're saying at the, from a general point of view. Now, this same poll has 29% of the voters think their representative in Congress deserves re-election. And so you got to wonder, well, if it's only getting 8% of the people to believe they're doing a good job, why are 29% of them thinking that they need to be reelected? The other amazing statistic that I found out there was now the same thing shows up in, if you ask people specifically on their representative whether they think they're doing a good job and they should be reelected, the numbers are about 49-50% range, which says, I think, really that we're really looking at things from a political aspect, the party aspect there. People are either one side or the other, and so if they've got a Democrat in there and they're a Democrat, they'll keep him in. If he's Republican, they want him, keep him in if they're Republican. So, but we really have to make a change, and I think it's time for that change. This particular statement I'm going to make is totally independent, personal view, not paid by for any dark money or political action committee, nothing like that. It's just my small part to remind the voters in Congressional District 3, which is where I live, get out and vote. It will count. Vote for Gabby Salcido Mercer. It's time for a change. Mr. Grijalva needs to be retired. That's my viewpoint, and that's totally independent, mine only. But let's take the time and get out there. It's time to use some of Solomon's wisdom to bear upon those running in this election. It's time to let them hear our voices. We'll be back with more of Solomon on Blast after this message. You want to join in? 750-7456. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Solomon on Blast. In our first story here, Solomon says in Proverbs that every prudent man acts with knowledge, but a fool lays open his folly. And that's kind of the general thought on this particular story. But there's also another thought that kind of ties in, and that is Proverbs 14:4, where no oxen are, the trough is clean. But much increase comes by the strength of an ox. So think about those two a little bit. And we'll go into this first story. Shocking new research shows pollution inequality in America is even worse than income equality. We're living in a polluted inequality environment, Fred.
Yeah, that's interesting story here. The man they're interviewing, James Boyce, a professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, makes the point of, and he thinks he's really shocked by this, which I personally, Doug, I don't think it's that shocking at all. I think these are economic issues, environmental issues are inseparable in my mind.
Right. The point he makes in this particular article is that there is a, the person interviewing him in this article says she was researching or interviewing him on the impact of environmental inequality on politics, education, economics, and the shape of our society. So he's been working on this data for years, collecting it and analyzing it, and finds out that if you live in an area, typically in the poorer areas, that there's more pollution in those areas. At least that's what their reports are coming out with. And in reality, when you look through this, he says, we've been working with these data for several years now in collaborative research with researchers from University of Michigan, Southern California, and several other institutions. And we've done a variety of studies that look in particular at patterns of environmental injustice, he states, in the U.S. along the lines of disproportionate exposure of people of color and low-income communities. And he says, what's new is we've developed three different inequality measures and applied those to this to find out that people that are, there's higher rates of exposure to pollution for people of color versus whites and people living below the federal poverty line versus the non-poor.
Well, I mean, how do you separate money from environment? People that have money will put more money into their environment. They will make sure their neighborhoods look better. They will make sure their streets are paved better. They will make sure the sidewalks are nice and clean.
Look at the foothills, Catalina foothills.
Absolutely.
Now look down where all the industrial development
But I'll tell you, one of the unspoken aspects of this, and I would put it this way, should be an ode to the middle class. Because wherever you have a strong middle class, even though the entire city's not going to be beautified,
right,
the more middle class people you have, the better the city's going to look
overall.
Across the board overall. So the environment will be better if people are economically doing better. But here's the catch, and it comes out in the proverb that you used. You've got to anticipate a dirty stall if you want to get some business, right?
Right. There's not going to be any thing to clean up after, but if you want progress, if you want increase, if you want the economy to grow, it's going to take a little bit of work.
Yeah, you can manicure a cemetery, right?
Yeah, nobody's going to bother you.
No one's going to bother you. You can get that thing just right for the most part. And that's the idea. This is where the environmentalists completely fall off. Everybody wants a clean environment.
Absolutely.
I want a nice street. I want clean water. I think that's off the top. But where they fail this is to realize that it's a robust economy that gives you the best opportunity to create a good environment.
Right, and good neighborhoods, clean neighborhoods. And one of the things in looking through this, you know, the federal government does a significant amount of work in housing the poor. Well, they don't do anything to house the poor in the foothills of the Tucson Mountains or the Catalina Mountains. They don't do anything to house the poor in Scottsdale. They typically find the housing in the areas where it's low income.
Although there is one exception to that in San Francisco.
Of course, there would be in San Francisco.
In San Francisco, there is a housing project on the north end of the cable car turnaround. I mean, as you get off the cable car turnaround to the
all
north,
the way at the top,
to go to Fisherman's Wharf, you walk through two housing projects on either side of the street. Now, I'm sure there are developers licking their chops, waiting for the opportunity to buy those from the city, and I'm sure they'll be sold at some point. But you still see that in San Francisco.
Okay.
Some of the most expensive oceanfront property on earth are sit housing projects.
And it's sitting there in San Francisco, and it's developed for the low income.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. They're low income they're housing projects, just right there on the foot of.
Now, are they clean?
They have to be, because you have just thousands and thousands and thousands of tourists pouring through there every week, and they're relatively safe, believe it or not. I mean, at least that's what the feeling you have.
So this would that particular environment would totally violate his study with regards to
absolutely
the poor living in pollution areas.
It's the most amazing environment you can imagine, and they're living right in the middle of it.
Okay. So, yeah, when you start looking at this, it's the government does have a lot of impact on where the people, especially the ones living under the poverty level, where they're getting entitlements, they're going to be where the government puts them in the housing. But
well, what's so also about this is this is probably a great theme that all of us are constantly harping on, and that's the hypocrisy of the elite, where they make sure that they are living in places that are carefully protected by the police force, and they make sure that they're not anywhere near all of the threats that you get with all the social issues that they seem to champion.
Right.
Well, a great example of that, going back to, San Francisco and Marin County. The BART, which is the Bay Area
Rapid
basically
Transit
subway stations that are all over the Bay Area, did not put any stations in Marin County. And that was always really curious because the bridge is so expensive, the Golden Gate Bridge, and I mean, it's just packed every single day. Why wouldn't you put BART stations when they were laying that out in Marin County. Well, I think...
The rich live there.
Absolutely. The last thing they want are homeless people taking the train and sleeping and camping out...
In their neighborhood.
Exactly. On stations. Yeah. So they don't want people to have... So what you do is you basically price people out of the game, and then you can have all espouse all the liberal politics you want.
Right. And he goes on to just continue this kind of... Like I said at the beginning... Proverbs, he says, every prudent man acts with knowledge, but a fool lays open his folly. And this guy just seems to be laying it out there, one comment after another, with regards to this study and the results that they got out of it. And it's really more of what I kind of talked about at the beginning, that it's the political division, right? Let's just divide things. The poor, the underprivileged here, people of one race versus another. You've got to find something to create that division and to cause problems. And this seems to be another means of doing it.
It sounds so alarming, but when you think about it, it's just the same old problem. And that is, you get people who live in socially disadvantaged situations in which economics plays a major part, but there are others. There's family issues, you know, and you start breaking all of that down, you're going to have a not so nice place to live at the end of all of that. And that's why every parent tells their kid, get your act together, because you don't want to end up on Skid Row, right?
Right. But being poor doesn't mean have to live in squalor either.
No.
And that isn't always the case, but that seems to be the aspect of what he's got going with this research.
Well, again, you think about a good economy with a strong middle class, and in that context, even people that don't have a lot of money can at least have access and exposure to a nicer environment.
Right.
And, you know, think about third world countries that have very small middle classes. The rich people in third world countries are rich.
Pure and simple.
All they do is put up a nice big fence, and everything inside that fence is first world. And, you know, they just keep out the third world. But that's not the kind of country we want here, Doug, right?
That's right. We want everybody to...
So, in my opinion...
Improve.
You keep the middle class strong and the environment will stay.
That's true.
Nice.
All right. We'll be coming back after this real quick commercial break with our next story. Debt and self-esteem. More is better. At least when you're young, maybe. That's what this particular article seems to say. We'll be right back. Solomon on Blast.
Hey, I wanna be on the cover of Forbes magazine, smiling next to Oprah and the Queen.
We're back. Solomon on Blast here on Power Talk 1210. Give us a call, 750-7456. Everybody wants to be a billionaire, or at least pretend to be. In this particular story, Solomon's thoughts on it: the blessing of the Lord makes one rich, and he adds no sorrow with it. So think about that, really, if we're looking to be rich, it should be from the blessings of the Lord, and there's not going to be any grief or sorrow when it comes from Him. But this particular story, debt and self-esteem seem to be what the young people are looking for, and more is better. The story says, do young people benefit from debt? Well, being in debt improves your self-esteem, but only until you're 21. And when it starts having the opposite effect, actually. This is the conclusion of a group of sociologists who queried adults age 18 to 34, analyzing their use of loans and credit cards out of the effect of family income, taking out the effect of family income, education, achievement, and other characteristics. They found that debt gives a boost to both self-esteem and mastery, a feeling, wonderful feeling there, of being in control in people age 18 to 27. Here's the real scary part. The larger the debt, the bigger the boost in their feelings of self-control and self-esteem. but that it actually erodes those two characteristics among people age 28 to 34. So the question is, does it really buy you anything to get into debt? Well, according to Solomon, no, because the blessings come from him and there's no sorrow with it.
Well, the obvious thing here, and they pointed out at the end of the article, is that when you're young, credit cards and loans allow you to live beyond your means. So they allow you to look the part. And so I could see the connection with self-esteem in that sense, that you get to wear really nice clothes, you get to drive a really nice car, you get to carry yourself in such a way that people think you got it going on, and that you get to play the part. And when you're young, let's face it, you can look good playing the part and actually have nothing. So I can see how it does relate to self-esteem.
Right.
Because you can feel pretty good about yourself if you're looking good in the mirror, at least at that moment.
Right. Until the credit card bill comes due. And like it says in this article, by the time you're about 28, people start realizing that they've got to have reality maybe starts kicking in at that point. And that's when they look at their real financial situation and begin to find out all that
what else happens in a man's life.
Typically
marriage right about that time. So now you don't live your life just to be cool and go to clubs and try to impress people and staying at the gym and buying all the supplements and all of those things that you probably, your GNC card's probably charged up pretty high. You're no longer doing that. So now you have a wife to worry about. You have, probably a mortgage or at least a living situation that's in a better environment. And then, so you got to please a woman, got to raise some kids, got to go trick-or-treating. I mean, it's a different world, and all of those things would begin to weigh on you, I think, pretty fast.
Yeah, and the women are typically much, much more conservative fiscally than the young men are. So they pretty much, at that point, begin to put their foot down and say, hey, no more spending for the fun stuff. This is real life here.
Yeah, so what I think this is, Doug, in reference to the proverb you used, this is just old-fashioned materialism. Lust of the flesh, lust of the eyes, the pride of life.
Definitely.
And it's just somebody wanting, just really coveting. You just want stuff, and you want to be able to experience stuff, and you put a high value on stuff, and the best way to get that stuff is credit cards and debt.
So the obvious thing is that not to get into debt, but I think a lot of the problems you see is that most of these young people have no real clue what it means to be financially adept at what they're doing.
Well, it's almost like they don't even care.
At that age, they've been probably coddled by mom and dad. Now, the article did make a comment that those people that are more wealthy have less of an impact. The debt has less of an impact on them, both from a self-esteem perspective.
Yeah, absolutely.
They know somebody's going to bail them out effectively, right?
Absolutely.
Is what it boils down to there.
We're talking about the average guy who's watching MTV, and he's not going to be able to live that kind of lifestyle unless he makes it big, which, the percentage, I'm not trying to destroy anybody's dream, but the percentages aren't really good in anybody's favor. And making to being the billionaire that Bruno Mars is talking about. So I think a lot of it is you want to ape pop culture, you're going to pay for it. And at some point you wake up and tell yourself that was a pretty stupid thing to do.
And the sorrow comes then. So going back to Solomon, blessing of the Lord is better to be rich by that because there is no sorrow with it. So we'll be coming back after this commercial break with another story. And the question there is, what's the millennials up to now?
Yeah, every third article, I think I see the word millennial in it today.
Yep. We'll be right back. That's what Solomon says. Remember now your Creator in the days of your youth before the difficult days come and the years draw near when you say, I have no pleasure in them. It seems losing our religion is what's happening, at least according to this particular article. America is becoming less religious. And the article talks about some surveys that have been going on that, especially among millennials, which, like I said, everything, like you said, everything seems to be, every third article's a discussion on the millennials, but the millennials are probably the largest group out there that is agnostic or atheist and literally walking away from their religion. If you look at the particular numbers here, percentage of the adult American generations with no religious affiliation, the millennials in the 18 to 24 range are up over 30% of them claim no religious affiliation. And as you get older, that number declines. Those 75 plus are way down in the about 6 or 7% claim no particular religious affiliation. And that seems to be a trend that's been going on. This particular article shows the percentage of adults with no affiliation from 1970 through 2000 and about 2012 for this particular article. And the graph looks like, as they explain it, a hockey stick with a big upturn starting right around 1990. That overall, the country's walking away from religion.
Well, I think we're in a post-Christian era, like we've been told, and I think that's really the truth. But there's a real important idea there. We are post-Christian. We're not just post-religious. That it's Christianity that is the foundation of you know, American culture. And it can sound extremely alarming in one context, Doug, but there's another context to this that I think actually it brings a certain kind of relief that you wouldn't see otherwise. And that is, because we are in a post-Christian era, there's a lot of young people, when they do become Christians, they are not nominal Christians.
They're not just out of nowhere.
They're sold out, devout Christians.
Right.
And I don't know if you could trace that number, how you could compare these figures in that sense, but I know sometimes it sounds like the sky is falling, but there's another side to this, and that is when people do become Christians, they're very serious about it, as because they have to make a stand. They got to show up. They got to represent.
Right. And in this particular study, I looked at some of the other details associated with it, and even though people are at the younger age of millennials are walking away from religion, they still have a belief in God. So that number hasn't really declined at all in any of the age groups, which leads you to believe that they're searching for something. They just don't know what it is at that point in time. And as they get older, like with the financial situation, reality begins to set in that there is a consequences to not having followed God in your life and the problems that you run into.
Right, and so they begin to discover why these issues were so important to their parents after a while, after you, like the prodigal son.
Right.
He did his thing, and then he came to his senses, and he realized that maybe his dad wasn't as stupid as he thought he was, basically.
Right. I've got a son like that.
But here's the question today about this post-Christian phase. And there's another very, very important question here. What will fill the vacuum? The assumption that people don't need to fill that vacuum, or that there's no vacuum, that it's just man kind of collectively moving forward in his evolution, in the evolutionary process. That's crazy. The truth is, man is religious by his very nature, and he will look to replace Christianity with something else.
So here's a number. Here's a number that'll go right along with that. In the past 20 years, federal outlays have grown 71% faster than inflation. So it's interesting that with a massive increase in federal spending coinciding with this increase in secularism, the government, is that a coincidence?
Is the government becoming their new God? Right. That would be the question.
And that seems to be, in some aspects of what we're seeing here. Part of it, like I said at the beginning, you know, there's a lot of division out there between the parties, and if people don't have a real solid moral foundation in which they base their beliefs on, then they're migrating to what the government tells them, the entitlement programs, that kind of thing, and that's going to change. Now, we've got a special One Greater Than Solomon segment today, so we're going to take a quick break, and we'll come back with our special guest today on our One Greater Than Solomon segment. Are we ready, Oscar, for that break? I'm just checking with you. Okay. All right, we'll be right back. You want to call in? Give us a call, 750-7456. Solomon on Blast. We'll be right back. We're back with Solomon on Blast. In our One Greater Than Solomon segment, we have a special guest with us, Nate Scribner. Welcome to the Power Talk 1210 studios, Nate.
Thank you. I'm glad
to be here. I don't know if his mic is on. Is his mic on? Go ahead and talk.
Thanks, yeah. I'm glad to be here.
Now we can hear you. All right.
Awesome.
Now, Nate, we've been talking about the millennials and losing their religion here. You're a young, up-and-coming filmmaker.
That's right.
And you seem to have maybe a little bit of experience with what we're talking about with regards to losing your religion, right?
Yes. I grew up in the church. My dad has been a pastor since before I was born. I'm 27 years old. He became the head pastor of the church that I grew up in the year after I was born. Church three times a week, often four times a week for me. And I did have a time where I did not believe in God. So I did lose my religion, I guess, as you could say. And for me, I think it had a lot to do with reading the Bible. I read the Bible every night ever since I was young, and I always read it from a certain perspective. And as soon as I went to college and heard a more intellectual perspective, quote unquote, a professor's perspective on the Bible, questioning like different scriptures and, you know, the meaning behind them, I would think about it a lot, and I took it very seriously, the questions that these professors had. So that it got to the point where I thought the Bible was completely false.
What particular area did you go into when you went into college that the professors were providing this kind of thing?
I would say philosophy classes, but I actually went to a Christian university, Pepperdine University, and it was actually a class on the Old Testament. I was a film major in college,
okay.
But at Pepperdine, they required to take general education and right. Bible classes as part of the curriculum. So we took Bible classes, and an Old Testament class was one of the classes.
And so at a university where you would expect to be getting more of a Christian input than you would in some of the normal state colleges and that kind of stuff, you're actually going the opposite direction then.
That's right. I think that class compounded with a lot of other classes. I did go to Santa Monica College before Pepperdine, which is a totally secular college.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, added to the effect as well. And then Pepperdine was almost liberal and conservative, I mean, in comparison to my upbringing.
Okay.
My upbringing is way more conservative than even Pepperdine University. So if you can understand that, being the pastor's kid, you're expected to be the example for the whole congregation. And my dad didn't make any sort of like if, ands, or buts about that. He said, I'm the pastor and you are my partnership. If you disobey, everyone in the church will disobey. If you watch a G-rated movie at the movie theaters, everyone else will go watch NC-17 films at the movie theater. And so there was no, like, you know, straying away from the path, or else you are the reason that your dad's credentials are falling apart.
Now, so, was your dad raised in a religious environment, and that's why he basically went in as a pastor?
No, he was raised in a religious environment, but I don't think that's why he became a pastor. I think he was raised in a Baptist community, and in his 20s, he was playing professional football, and he drank a lot. And his conversion story is more or less, you know, he got really drunk one night and crashed his car into a tree, woke up bloody. My mom, I think she was pregnant with my oldest brother at that time. And he just, I think he felt like he was really screwing up. There was a lot going on, I think, between my mom and my dad at that time, even like just like issues in their marriage. Right. And so I think he just was at a really low point and wanted to kill himself, is the way he tells the story. And so
it's just one generation after another of this is religion and this is what you're going to follow then. Everybody has that as a youth. You're going to wander away before you end up finding out that there isn't anything out there to be able to fill that need that you really need.
So, Nate, if I can chime in here, what helped you turn the corner? Okay, I can understand some of the Old Testament ideas seem so archaic, you know, and they start asking questions about why did they have to kill the Hittites and the Amorites and the Jebusites and all the ites that are out there. Okay, I can understand that, but what helped you turn the corner on that? I mean, and where you're able to settle your mind and say maybe there's some of these things don't make sense to me, but I believe that God is real. And
yeah, I think the ultimate turning point for me, those questions have never been answered for me, and I still don't understand why certain things are in there. But the major turning point for me was just getting to a point in my personal life where I felt so low that. You know, you're forced to realize, like, you know, I'm not really in control of what goes on.
But what were you doing at that time? What had you done after college that took you down that path?
Yeah, I've been working in documentary film editing and writing for the last 5 years. And on TV shows, you have tons of deadlines, deadline after deadline after deadline. And I'd always try and hire other editors and different people to help me do work, but I never really was able to get people to, I don't know, fit my standards, I guess. And so I would take way too much work on myself and stay up, you know, multiple nights on end trying to finish projects for a deadline, like sleep deprived, you know, no days off for like 6 months. And I knew I needed to do it in order to make enough money to stay financially in control of my life, but it was a miserable way to live. You know, I was making good money, you know, like close to like $80,000 a year at one point. And, you know, I was financially independent. I was probably what a lot of parents would want. You know, I got straight A's through college. I tried to do everything that was in my power to be successful, but I was totally miserable. And, you know, I just realized, like, I don't really have control over my own destiny. It's not really up to me. I can do everything right or what I think is right and be miserable. So maybe if I am not in control, maybe there's something out there that is.
Okay. And so then that's when you kind of came back around to where you were before you went into college.
Yeah. I think I'm definitely closer to God than before I went into college. Now I read my Bible every day. I read my Bible every day before, but I don't really read it from the same perspective. Before, I read it from the standpoint of, okay, here's my list of things that I need to do, right? You know, here's the Proverbs. Okay, that's what I need to do. So today I'm going to walk through life and obey this proverb right here. Mm-hmm. Now I read the Bible, and then I just like kind of sit there and pray and try and listen to God and just like say thank you, you know, for all the good things that are in my life. I think gratefulness is like one of the things that has helped me more than anything. Just like repeating the things that I'm grateful for, you know, like I really hated my dad for a while. And then I just said, you know, like I'm grateful for these things about him. I'm grateful that, you know, he never left my mom. I'm grateful that I have all these awesome brothers and sisters. I'm grateful that, you know, he was there to like coach me in football and these different things instead of resenting the controlling aspects or what I thought was controlling.
Right.
I think, Nate, you're bringing an exciting, refreshed definition of the word conversion, because people, we say the word conversion and you think of all these crazy life, you know, and the guy stopped doing, like even your dad's situation, which wasn't that as crazy. But conversion just means changing. having an opportunity, and in that opportunity, you change. So to answer, I guess to chime in on your answer about your conversion, yeah, what you're saying is being a having church kid religion is one thing, and yet having faith as an adult is another thing. And that's what you have converted to is the faith of an faith in Jesus as an adult, as opposed to a kid kind of trying to be good.
Yeah. I think a lot of my faith as a kid was also founded in my dad, you know? And as soon as I found out that my dad was maybe wrong about this or that, or I could like intellectually
got your own opinion about that.
Yeah. I could like outmaneuver him intellectually. Yeah.
Or you so you thought anyways, right?
Yeah. 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 Well, I mean I me and my dad are very different. I'm like a very like book guy. Like I read books, and my dad reads books, but like in school I always got good grades. My dad never got good grades in school. Like but he's great in like business and like, you know, relationships and like being a like really strong leader. I'm more of introverted, and so like there's certain things in like history and like just school wise that I would learn in college and be like, man, he's been like telling me the wrong thing for years or so I thought. So yeah, anyway, I mean, you kind of lose your, like my dad being the source of, you know, God, dad is like the God figure. Like right. He makes the rules and he's in control, to like now, you know, there is a God out there and I'm going to do my best, but he's actually the real one in control.
Mm-hmm. And that seems to kind of be what we see in these numbers from these particular research articles, is that people are losing it initially, but then they get to a point where they've realized that there isn't anything else out there that's going to solve the problems that they have.
Yeah.
So, Nate, what would you say to somebody your age going through exactly the same thing? How would you approach that? I know you'd have a lot of sympathy for where they, what they feel after thinking, but how would you kind of penetrate that barrier that people put up after a while?
Yeah, it's a tough question to answer because, I'm not really sure what the main thing for me that, like, really, like, oh, this one thing, like, turned the corner. But I'll give a few different examples. I think sometimes kids actually have to, like, go to that point where they really do feel that feeling of powerlessness and, like, total, like, it's just, like, a real, like, suffering feeling. And a lot of people, like, look at that in a negative way, you know, like, suffering is so bad and... that's why I don't believe in God, is because this super negative thing happened. But it's almost like you have to get to that point to realize, like, it's, you are not the one pulling the strings. Like, for me, that's what it was. Like, I'm a very prideful person. I think I can, like, accomplish anything. But you get to a point where you realize, like, well, I'm really not, you know, I'm not that in control. I would say that. And then I think a lot of kids in my generation are addicted to a lot of things. I mean, it's just like all over the place. And I think if you're addicted to something, getting over your addiction will give you a lot of self-confidence.
Yeah. And some of these articles, you see that these younger people are, they're not looking to buy houses. They're not looking to buy cars. They're addicted to their technology, their laptop, their tablet, whatever, their smartphone. And that's really what they're focusing on, and not looking at what life really has that in store for them.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. One of the best things I've done recently is I deleted every app off of my phone besides my email and my text messaging and, like, you know, calculator kind of thing, or like memos, just because I wanted to know, you know, could I be that self-controlled to not have any of those things and, you know, read, do other things. And that is one of the things that gives me more confidence than anything, is to know, like, all right, I don't need any of this stuff. And, so if anyone's addicted out there, I think that's one of the things that, and you may be in denial about that, but if you could get over that and find a way to develop a good habit in your life, it's very empowering.
And the addiction doesn't have to be what most people normally think is addiction, the drugs, the alcohol, that kind of stuff. Obviously, like you said, you were addicted to work, the technology out there, the addiction to that.
Yeah.
There's more to it than just what most people consider addictions.
Yeah, another big topic, I don't know how much time we have, but for kids in church, sex and dating, huge topic. For me, like, I wasn't allowed to date in high school because you know, that's like this big taboo. You know, you don't want to get, you don't want to kiss before marriage. You don't, like, this is going to sound radical to some people. Like, my brother did not kiss his wife before marriage, and that was like an awesome thing that they did to try and be holy, you know, set apart for God. But for me, like, I felt guilty about every, like, lustful thought I had, and I broke up with my first girlfriend because I was so, like, guilty about, you know, I can't do anything with her, or, you know, and I'm not going to be able to get married for years. Like, how can I just, like, go talk to her every night and, like, sit right next to her and not, like, try and kiss her or anything? And so, yeah, I was really frustrated for a long time. Like, I was addicted to, like, masturbating when I was in college, for sure, because I couldn't, I felt like there's no near future where I'm going to be married and I'm going to be able to do this in the way that, quote unquote, the church thinks is right. And so, you know, and then I'm just like, have these urges that every kid has in their teenage years. Right. And you're like, how do I get through this time? You know, there's no real end in sight. You know, like, God, where are you? Where's my, you know, spouse or whatever? So I think that's another thing kids face. And it's a really difficult trial. Like, it definitely was a major trial for me, and anyone going through that, it's not easy. And I think the major thing you need to do is, like, just talk to people about it and let other people know that you're going through it, because
most people think they're the only ones that are going through anything.
Yeah.
And in reality, everybody out there is going through the same kind of environment.
What I'm hearing is one of the greatest struggles about trying to come through and get a real grasp on your faith is you got to keep it real. And a lot of kids probably don't think it's real after a while. And, it, you know, they got to play this part for so many years, and they're just tired of it. It's not real, you know. And one of the greatest warnings Jesus gave about religion is hypocrisy, that people wind up inadvertently playing a part as opposed to being what they need to be.
So, yeah. So what are you doing here in Tucson?
I'm in Tucson. What's going on? I was very fortunate to, this is almost like a miracle, I feel, but, like, I was very fortunate to have Pastor Fred Ruby in the Door Christian Church in Tucson, and another guy named Aiden invite me to work on a documentary film about a woman's testimony here in Tucson. So I'm doing an interview this weekend to learn her story.
And you're going to do a documentary?
Yeah.
On it?
Yeah. Okay. Testimony film.
Well, Nate, we really appreciate having you here on Solomon on Blast this week. And as usual, we will be back with God's will. We will be back next week. And until then, oh, I can't leave without saying, don't forget the flash mob, Tucson Mall, 2 o'clock. So until next week, think wisely.